From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy argued this weekend before the American Bar Association that American prison terms are too long. Many mandatory minimum sentences should be abolished, and taxpayer money is being misspent on vast prison populations. The Justice Department disagrees, and it will begin compiling data on judges it considers overly lenient. Critics call that a blacklist. John Ashcroft calls for toughness. But have we got the balance right? Tonight on Point, judges, mandatory minimums, and clashing visions of justice in America. We begin in San Francisco, where the American Bar Association's annual meeting is underway. I asked the association's incoming president, Dennis Archer, what Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy said about the impact of federal sentencing guidelines.
Justice Kennedy observed that, in his view, the Bar Association ought to look at whether the time has come to end mandatory sentences. For example, and he gave one in his remarks, if you were driving on a street that happened to be governed by the federal authorities, say a park or something like that, and you were stopped because you didn't have a seatbelt on, and in the search of the car, there was a finding of 5 grams of crack cocaine, that if you were convicted, you would go to jail for 5 years.
Because it would be a federal crime, and that would be the minimum allowed.
That is the sentence. There's no discretion. You go to jail for 5 years. No opportunity for probation. No opportunities for serve a little time and then come out. You go for 5 years.
Justice Kennedy said, our resources are misspent, our punishments too severe, our sentences too long. How was that received by the membership at the Bar Association convention? Is this a widely shared view? It's certainly not Attorney General John Ashcroft's view, as far as we can tell.
Well, Tom, let me just say that the American Bar Association has, by way of policy, opposed mandatory sentences because it takes away from the judge's discretion as to how much time to impose, and it entrusts, in effect, with either the U.S. Attorney's Office in the case of federal court actions or in the case of prosecuting attorneys or district attorneys in state courts, where it is up to the prosecutor. If the prosecutor at the very beginning makes the charge, then the judge has no discretion whatsoever. The person could have been a saint. The person could have had absolutely the cleanest record in the world, could have a lot of things going for him, but just made a dumb, stupid mistake, got caught, and now this person goes to jail for 5 years.
Dennis Archer, you've been around the block. You've been mayor of Detroit, a justice on the Michigan Supreme Court, now just elected president of the American Bar Association. What's your sense of the context of Justice Kennedy's remarks here? Is there a real movement afoot that might have a chance of abolishing mandatory minimums, or is he whistling in the wind?
No, I think what will occur, we have accepted the suggestion of Mr. Justice Anthony Kennedy as an American Bar Association, and we're going to have a task force made up of a number of different sections and perhaps even reach outside that will look at whether or not the time has come to work for the repeal of mandatory sentences, to work for reducing the sentence guideline minimums. In other words, the minimum might be 5 to 20, and the recommendation that may be forthcoming after examining what's going on could be 1 to 20, but you still keep the upper limit. Take a look at the prison conditions and what's being done for the person incarcerated. Do we give them a training, et cetera? And so we want to look at this to see whether or not we should advocate the changes that the justice has asked us to look at.
Meanwhile, on the other side of the street, John Ashcroft, Attorney General, has announced that his department will be tracking judges' sentencing records to see if they are being too lenient, the implication being that there'll be some consequences if they're too lenient. Clearly, the Bush administration is pushing in the opposite direction. The Attorney General seems to suggest that sentences are too light.
Well, I think what the Attorney General, which is his right to ask, of course, he's asking his lawyers in the U.S. Attorney's Office throughout the country that when a trial court judge in a district court level deviates from the sentence guidelines. That is to say, probation department, et cetera, the U.S. Attorney's Office, may say that this crime that has been committed by this person found guilty or pled guilty deserves to go to jail for 5 years. The judge may, in the exercise of his discretion, where the judge does have discretion, may feel that based upon the facts of the case, the background, et cetera, of a person convicted, that the person should only go to jail for 3 years or 4 years, or in some rare instance, may even be entitled to probation. It is in that setting that the Attorney General wishes to gather the information for what purposes. He certainly would know better than I. I confess I was a little surprised on one hand. Let me tell you why.
Mm-hmm.
At a time when President Bush is working so hard to get his nominees through the Senate Judiciary Committee and then the full Senate, at that kind of setting, then now Attorney General Ashcroft wants to gather this information. Senator Kennedy responded to a question, at least I don't know if it was taken out of context or not, but felt that what was being suggested or what is going to be done by the Attorney General's office would be to interfere with judicial independence.
He called it a blacklist of judges, Senator Kennedy did. The New York Times said today that by trying to make federal judges yield to political pressure from Washington, the Bush administration is engaging in a radical attack on our constitutional system. Dennis Archer, newly elected president of the ABA, do you agree?
Well, I'll just simply suggest that I find it ironic that in the 200th anniversary of Marbury versus Madison, going back to the framers, looking at the United States Constitution, 200 years ago in that litigation, it was pronounced that there should be judicial independence,
mm-hmm.
and that whether appointed or elected, judges should have the freedom to work within the rules based upon the facts, based upon the law, and exercise their discretion.
The other issue that's big in the legal front at this point is lawyers being pressured to give up some ground on client confidentiality.
Well, let me put it this way, Tom. I don't think the predicate should be pressured. I think there is a legitimate discussion on whether or not the American Bar Association should support a resolution that, in effect, puts us in the same line with 42 other states. The American Bar does not have in their model rules of professional conduct that which 42 other states have been doing in different aspects of it for some time now. And I will also suggest to you, we've not had a resolution come from any one of those 42 states that says, hey, guys, wait a minute. Something's going on wrong here, crazy, because we can't get our clients won't talk to us anymore.
So you don't see a real imposition looming on client confidentiality here?
No, I don't.
Dennis Archer, thank you very much for your time with us. Much appreciated.
Tom, you're so kind. Thank you very much for having me. Hope we get a chance to visit with you again.
Dennis Archer is the incoming president of the American Bar Association. He spoke to us from the ABA's annual meeting today in San Francisco. While Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy railed over the weekend against federal sentencing guidelines and mandatory minimums, not all judges agree with him. And the Justice Department has an entirely different take. With closer tracking, it hopes to clamp down on judges who use independent judgment. Does Justice Kennedy have it right? Or should judges be firmly steered toward uniform, heavy sentences? Do you want judges' discretion to be overruled by federal guidelines? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Charles Hobson, attorney at the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation in Sacramento. It's a victims' rights group which advocates swift and sure execution of justice. Good evening and welcome, Charles Hobson.
Nice to be here, Tom.
Good to have you. Also with us is Mary Price, general counsel at the Families Against Mandatory Minimums in Washington, D.C. Good evening and welcome, Mary Price.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Charles Hobson, you no doubt have read the comments that Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy made over the weekend before the ABA in San Francisco. He is generally a conservative on issues of criminal justice, but he's saying here there's not enough latitude given the federal guidelines that have been developed since 1984 and that discretion's being pushed out and justice isn't being done. Unwise and unjust, he's saying. What do you think of his remarks?
They're very, very interesting. I think it's good that the state is a judge rather than being a legislator. I'm a little concerned that judges are speaking on policy matters like this, but they do that, and we can't avoid that. It also shows, though, that judges are political actors, and that it's not like you take a test to become a judge, but you usually wind up knowing somebody in politics, and that's how you get selected to be a judge. The idea that judges are immune from politics, or even immune from just being human beings, is false, and it's one of the reasons why we have things like the federal sentencing guidelines, which were terribly, terribly criticized by judges when they came out, and things like mandatory minimum sentences. I'm not going to defend every mandatory minimum sentence, but certainly Congress has it within its rights and within its power to enact mandatory minimum sentences, as Justice Kennedy realized when he upheld them. The problem is, if you give judges total discretion, which is what we had many, many years ago, you get wildly different sentences depending upon who happened to be the judge in your case.
But we're moving far away from total discretion towards something much more closely monitored under this new Justice Department plan. Prosecutors would be required to report any time a judge deviated from the federal guidelines. The critique here says that this, we're a kind of fork in the road, two visions of justice here, one that permits discretion, one that enforces uniformity. Do you vote for uniformity there, Charles Hobson?
Well, actually, I think uniformity is a very, very good idea. There are a couple, the whole idea behind the discretion to begin with was the idea that you could somehow find a right, absolutely just sentence for each person. In part, it was based upon the idea that the judge could somehow read into the person's soul or their ability or predict how dangerous they were going to be in the future or how amenable they were to being rehabilitated. And time after time, we found that just isn't the case, both studies and experience. One of the reasons, we had this system. It created enormous dissatisfaction, and it's why you've seen this move against it.
But do we not have a pendulum swing the other direction? Even Chief Justice William Rehnquist warned Congress that restrictions on discretionary sentencing, quote, would seriously impair the ability of courts to impose just and reasonable sentences. Are just and reasonable sentences being walked away from here, Charles Hobson?
Remember, judges are human beings. People hate being told what to do, particularly federal judges, because, quite frankly, federal judges usually aren't told what to do. They're the only people I know who can never get fired. You basically have to convict them of a crime in the Senate to get rid of them, and they don't, and the overwhelming majority of them don't. I think there have been seven in the history of the United States that have actually been successfully impeached in the last 200-plus years that we've had the federal judicial system. Part of it is just a matter of human nature. Now, yes, you can find times where there are excessive sentences from mandatory minimums for some sentences, but there also were many, many times, particularly in the prior administration of justice, where you would wind up with grotesquely light sentences because judges had discretion. Actually, I was just reading one today. If you remember last year during a Chicago White Sox-Kansas City Royals game, these two men came out, the man and his son came out and beat up basically the first base coach. The guy got 30 months probation, even though the coach says permanent damage to his ear.
So it doesn't sound good in that case, but Mary Price, let me bring you in here. What do you think of where we're headed? Here's Anthony Kennedy right at the top of the American judicial system on the Supreme Court saying, we've got punishments that are too severe, sentences that are too long, and justice that's not just or wise. And this is not a liberal, Anthony Kennedy.
No, he's not at all. I was delighted, actually, to be at that talk and also to hear Mr. Archer's commitment from the ABA to follow up on Justice Kennedy's suggestions. I think we should step back for a second. We've talked a couple of times of suggestions that somehow judges are deviating from the guidelines or by using their discretion or the departure authority. Departures are not a dirty word. They were built into the guideline system by Congress.
Departures, that is, giving judges the ability to say, I want to make a departure from the guideline in this particular case for this reason and go lower.
Exactly. Judges who have in front of them the circumstances of the offense, the person of the offender standing in front of them, who have all the information from the defense and the prosecution about what's gone into the crime and who this person is, from time to time, judges will depart from the otherwise recommended guideline sentence. That's not an evasion of the law. It's not a deviation from the guidelines. It is, in fact, a component of the system that was established by Congress back when the Sentencing Reform Act was promulgated in the mid-1980s.
Mary Price, hold that thought. As you know, John Ashcroft is now looking to bring pressure on judges who take advantage of that. However, we're talking tonight with Charles Hobson and Mary Price about American justice and judges versus the Justice Department. asking, are sentences too heavy or too light? Does Justice Kennedy have it right? Are American prison terms simply too long, too harsh? Or does Maximum John Ashcroft have it right that U.S. judges need to be firmly steered toward heavy sentences? You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about American justice and judges versus the Justice Department. We're looking at blacklists and mandatory minimums. Prisons very full in the United States of America. You can join the conversation. Do you want judges' discretion to be limited by federal sentencing guidelines, by federal minimums? And is stepped-up Department of Justice oversight eroding the separation of powers, the independence of the judiciary? And I guess, do you generally trust judges to do the right thing, to be just, to be tough enough, or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight are Charles Hobson, attorney at the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation, a criminal rights group based in Sacramento, California. And joining us from Washington, D.C., Mary Price, general counsel for Families Against Mandatory Minimums, a national organization dedicated to promoting flexible sentencing guidelines. We're joined now from Palo Alto, California, by Robert Weisberg. He's professor of law at Stanford University. Good evening and welcome, Robert Weisberg.
Good evening. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Quite an unusual, prominent statement by Anthony Kennedy this weekend before the American Bar Association. Not the first time he's expressed misgivings about mandatory sentencing guidelines. But what do you make of all this, Robert Weisberg? Are we reaching a kind of boil in this debate over guidelines, minimums, and monitoring of judges' behavior? Are we coming to some kind of turning point, or are we headed straight on toward tougher, harsher, heavier penalties?
Well, the recent federal legislation, the so-called Feeney Amendment, clearly has brought things to a kind of boiling point. It's important, first of all, to distinguish a few things which are related but not the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
The guidelines as opposed to mandatory minimum sentences. Guidelines significantly constrain the range in which federal judges can issue sentences, but
Right. Don't
by themselves mandate their absolutely required sentences for particular crimes. On the other hand, independent of the guidelines, for certain federal crimes and for lots of state crimes, there are absolutely mandatory sentences. So the two sort of get conflated. Nevertheless, I think federal judges in particular have felt increasingly exasperated in recent years by their inability to do what they see as their main task, which is to exercise judgment. And I think the atmosphere got quite overheated earlier this spring when the original version of the federal legislation, which became known as the Feeney Amendment, was proposed, which would have really radically come close to eliminating all judicial discretion in sentencing. It was so extreme that the administration and the Republicans in Congress quickly retreated and worked out a compromise, and the final law that was passed is nearly severe as the original proposed bill was.
And yet there's this kind of backdoor piece of it all that we're just learning about in the last few days, whereby the Justice Department is now going to be monitoring judges.
Correct. Now, there is provision in the law, I mean, as mandated by Congress, that the Attorney General is to report to the Congress on the scope and the frequency of departures under the federal guidelines.
That means when judges go below the federal guidelines.
Well, or above, but just
or above,
below.
Yes, but typically
something
below.
They're perfectly entitled to do, as Ms. Price suggested, under the guideline structure as set up in the 1980s. What's happened in the last few days is that the Attorney General has very aggressively interpreted that mandate by Congress, issued this directive to prosecutors around the country to maintain these lists. Now, the notion of a blacklist is a funny thing. First of all the sentences that would be listed are matters of public record anyway. It doesn't involve snooping into private information.
Well, not exactly yet. It creates a potentially powerful tool and packages it quite differently than it's been in the past. I mean, the suggestion even that we have a transgression of separation of powers here, that the leverage could become so great.
Yes, but the Attorney General can't violate the constitutional principle of separation of powers. He's following a congressional mandate. He's acting at least loosely within the boundaries of it. Second of all, of course, as he probably would admit, even if he thought that a particular federal judge had been wildly irresponsible in her departures, the attorney general has no power to take any sanctions against that federal judge. So we're in this gray area where we're talking about framing of the data, political publicity about certain judges, and so on.
But it also affects the prosecutor's behavior, doesn't it? I mean,
yes.
No prosecutor wants the attorney general of the United States to be breathing down his or her neck and saying, what kind of job are you doing? As you know, many of these more lenient sentences that are handed down have been handed down in cooperation with prosecutors.
Yes,
prosecutors kind of signing off on them and saying, yeah, that makes sense.
I think the political and institutional concern is that the attorney general has, shall we say, a rather extremely top-down, centralized view of the way the system works. Some prosecutors, although they're not going to be as open about their feelings as Justice Kennedy was or other judges are, some prosecutors probably feel that, well, they're hired and paid and trained to exercise some discretion and to negotiate some things with other parties and to arrange things with the court. And here, a central bureaucracy in Washington is going to be telling them what to do, and they feel that that shows a certain insensitivity to the institutional dynamics of prosecution. Even more dramatically, and this has been going on for quite a while, federal judges have been upset by the guidelines and the mandatory minimum. And clearly, Justice Kennedy was making a statement not on behalf of a political ideology, but he was standing for the sort of fellowship and sisterhood of federal judges and sort of saying to Ashcroft in particular, but mm-hmm. to some extent to Congress, for God's sake, we know you can't cross any constitutional lines, but you're showing remarkable insensitivity to the way the system should work.
Charles Hobson, how about it? Anthony Kennedy has said that the country has a long tradition for the sentencing judge to consider every convicted person as an individual and every case as a unique study in human failings that sometimes mitigated, sometimes magnify the crime and punishment. Are you voting for the centralized justice notion, the idea that a judge needn't have that kind of discretion given the firsthand view of the facts of a case?
Well, first of all, the discretion isn't withdrawn to the Justice Department. It's taken away to the extent that it is by Congress or by state legislators. It's also worthwhile noting that most criminal sentencing and most criminal prosecution is a state matter. And yes, generally speaking, there had been a fair amount of discretion, not so much at the very beginning of the country where most criminal penalties were death or prison grew somewhat later from the very beginning of the founding of the Constitution, for most felonies at least. You saw deviations away from discretion in sentencing as early as the 1970s. California, the state I'm from, we basically abolished a large amount of the discretion in sentencing in the 70s. In the case of California, before that, a lot of it was done by parole boards or probation departments, mm-hmm. which you would also find in a lot of other states. So the idea that the judges always had this, there's some degree of accuracy, but it's a more complicated story. More importantly, it's always been the legislature that has set the ultimate sentences for the crime. And since it's the legislature that sets the sentences for the crime, as everybody's noted, it's certainly within their constitutional power, and the problem you wind up having with when you had this discretion was you had enormous disparities sometimes between sentences depending upon which type of judge you had.
Mary Price, take us into the details a little bit. We read some fairly dire descriptions of what's going on, the notion of the country now facing a choice between two visions of justice. Jonathan Turley, he's a law professor at George Washington Law School, has written about justice being blind and handcuffed here, heavily centralized, discretion out the window. We've heard from Charles Hobson about the dangers of too much discretion in his view, but are the dangers on the other side here of all kind of the human awareness of what's going on in an individual case being lost?
Oh, I think absolutely. And I think the other deep concern that we have is that if departure authority is eliminated or strictly constrained in the future, that you're going to see an increasing shift in discretion away from judges into the hands of prosecutors who can control charging decisions, who can control the plea bargaining, who can and do control the plea bargaining process. Right now, something like 97% of all drug cases at the federal level are resolved by plea. So you can imagine at that front end, already there is a tremendous amount of discretion in the hands of judges. And I want to say something. One of the reasons that this particular Protect Act was passed was statement on the...
This is the Feeney Amendment this spring in April.
The Feeney Amendment was is now contained in what is the larger legislation is called the Protect Act.
Mm-hmm.
There's not an epidemic of leniency in the federal judiciary, and there's been a great deal of discussion about this. Back in March, the Justice Department testified before the Sentencing Commission and said the pattern now seems clear that federal judges are using downward departures frequently, in some cases nearly routinely, as a way of avoiding imposing the prescribed guideline sentence. Well, that's simply not true. In fact, what we see is that the majority of downward departures are controlled by or acquiesced in by the government. And there are several different ways they do that. Some of them are called substantial assistance departures, which are departures that are given to defendants who are willing to provide testimony or information about other people, other people's criminal conduct.
We read there that according to the American Bar Association, that prosecutors have appealed only 19 of more than 11,000 sentence reductions. So in many instances, they're clearly cooperating.
Exactly. I mean, and that's one of the big checks on the system. I mean, if the government believes that the departure is unwarranted, they have the right to appeal the departure to the Court of Appeals, and many of those are not. But I want to just step back for a second and talk about where discretion sits right now, because increasingly it's being shifted to the front end of the system, where it happens
to the prosecutors, you mean?
In the plea bargaining process, because it happens behind closed doors. The other large
What is the problem with that, Mary Price? I want to understand. As you see,
justice should be in the open, because judges have always judged in a defendant in front of them in an open courtroom.
So, in other words, you're saying,
record.
In effect,
but
the prosecutor can say to the accused, "There's no discretion here. You deal with me, or I don't know what. And here's what you get."
Or I'll bring a greater charge.
Mm-hmm.
I'll charge a larger amount of drugs,
and
those things are said to defendants. And we're concerned that will happen more as the system changes. Who controls departures? The ABA says that 79% of all departures are controlled by the government.
So, in other words, the prosecutors themselves have said, let's go in a different direction. I want to bring some callers in. A lot of them have been waiting to join us. Todd's calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Todd. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to agree with a few things that were just said. I agree that, that the rulings and the findings should be out in the open and not behind closed doors.
Okay.
Because that's deceiving, and you don't really know what's being said. And I think it gets a little more complicated to whereas, the judge makes a ruling and then, the person goes through the system and, it gets hard when you get to have time to go on probation.
Which direction do you think things should be going, Todd? Toward discretion on the part of judges or toward clear minimums?
Clear minimums. Absolutely.
And why?
Well, because, most people are willing to take a gamble.
You mean potential criminals saying, "Well, I'll probably get let off, so let's rob the bank."
Right. I mean, you see it on TV all the time, and I'm sure it happens in real life. I mean, if there was just one sentence that they were going to get, and there was, no minimums, no maximums, they know what they're in for then. So if you're going to commit a crime, then you pay the consequence.
Todd, we've got it. Thanks for your call, Robert Weisberg. You know that the view Todd's just expressed here became quite widely held, at least in the 80s. It was behind this legislation in the first place. Where do you see the politics of this question right now? Jonathan Turley writes about the U.S. looking at two visions of justice. Where's it headed?
Well, it's probably headed towards a further tightening up on the federal level, and that's because of the nature of federal politics. Here's the funny thing. Federal politicians, legislators in particular, have far less influence over criminal justice than most people realize because, as has been suggested, the vast majority of criminal prosecutions take place in the states. However, most of the political discussion in American elections about crime tends to be a kind of demagogic soundbite war, with all politicians, and both Democrats and Republicans, moving as far to the right as possible. So every once in a while, legislators who are running for office think, oh, my God, I have to campaign on toughening up sentences, even though the sentences in the U.S. are already both higher and more rigid than they are anywhere else in the world, so we keep getting this ratcheting up. The interesting thing is that there's a counter-movement in the states right now, as I think Ms. Price mentioned, A number of states are now in the process of relaxing their own mandatory minimum drug sentences that were enacted largely in the 1970s. They were frequently known as Rockefeller sentence laws because spearheading this extremely unfortunate movement was Governor Nelson Rockefeller in the 1970s.
And what's pushing this pullback from those mandatory state sentences?
The kinds of organizations that Ms. Price represents have always been there, those that have simply argued, and very convincingly for many criminologists, that the sentences are completely beyond anything that is necessary for criminal deterrence. They're simply much too severe, and they're much too costly in the sense of taking away many years of people's lives and therefore greatly hurting the lives of their families, for no particular deterrent purpose.
Also expensive for the states to support those prison populations.
That's what I was going to say is the newest component in this. What you're seeing in the states now is a very surprising bipartisan coalition, and in fact, it's most notably led in certain states by Republican governors who have more political freedom to argue for softening sentences than liberal Democrats.
Because they don't have to protect their right flank.
Correct. What's happened is, particularly at a time of economic distress around the country, the real price has been made more evident. In other words, we've reached the point when state budget discussions have come to recognize that the amount of prison space dedicated to mandatory minimum drug sentenced inmates is simply too much for the state to
bear. So is the federal debate then, Robert Weisberg, a kind of sideshow here? Is the real action at the state level? Is the center of gravity shifting there? You said earlier that you thought we were generally headed toward more centralized, tougher sentences.
They're moving in somewhat different directions, and that's because state budgets are much more immediately sensitive to the crime problem. And even though, legislators in the state system are perfectly capable of demagogic behavior, they have to be somewhat more responsive to fiscal and political reality. There's simply more freedom for federal legislators to play the soundbite game. So right now, they're moving in different directions. The cost issue in terms of prison costs is not nearly as significant on the federal level as it is on the state level. Where it is significant on the federal level as well as on the state level is the cost in human misery. Unnecessarily long incarceration of nonviolent criminals and the effects on their families, but that doesn't have a lot of political salience.
Charles Hobson, expensive in budgetary terms and expensive in human suffering, and it doesn't work anyway. But you're still standing up for mandatory guidelines.
First of all, it depends upon which one. I'm certainly in favor of tough sentences overall. It's worth noting, however, in California, the most famous of, in effect, mandatory minimum sentences, the three strikes provisions. California is suffering a massive, massive budget shortfall. There have been repeated efforts to try and strike down the three strikes law, or at least place it on the ballot. It would have to be placed on the ballot to amend it. And it failed again this year. There will be some states where people may be working against it, but although as a practical matter, it's also ultimately it's the expression of the people through their legislators who are going to determine whether or not you have mandatory minimum sentences.
Clearly that. Charles Hobson, stand by. We're talking tonight about American justice and judges versus the Justice Department. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about American justice and judges versus the Justice Department on the issue of discretion in sentencing. Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy, just this past weekend at the American Bar Association meeting in San Francisco, saying that too many mandatory minimum sentences are unwise and unjust. You can join our conversation tonight. Has a generation of mandatory minimums made American society more just or just filled the jails? And does federal justice need a liberalizing overhaul or to be toughened up even more? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by Charles Hobson with the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation in Sacramento, California, by Mary Price from Washington, D.C., with Families Against Mandatory Minimums, and from Stanford University Law School, Robert Weisberg, professor of law at Stanford Law School. You can join the conversation as well. Michael's calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi. I think we'll never be able to escape the tension between uniformity and fairness.
Mm-hmm.
But specifically, I don't think Congress people are going to be really concerned about this until their own, well, their own families are subject to mandatory minimum themselves.
Their own families, you mean, in what circumstance?
Well, Eric Schlosser, the author of Reefer Madness, among others, has a list of children of Congress people who were caught with significant amounts of drugs, none of whom were given these high minimum sentences because they weren't charged.
So you're saying the Congress people were happy for judicial discretion in the cases of their own children?
Well, there was prosecutorial discretion that was exercised, so they were charged under lesser charges, and so they weren't subject to the mandatory minima. And I think, in general, any prosecutor given for a young man who's made a mistake but who otherwise might have a bright future in front of him, in the choice between preferring charges that could result in a mandatory minimum, which would result in a permanent stay on his record, would go for a lesser charge as opposed to be blunt, some ghetto boy.
So there's the kind of class and power differential. Mary Price, let me put that to you. Do you see judges' discretion being used, as our caller Michael suggests, to advantage the powerful?
No, and I think what he was suggesting was just what I was concerned about, that the discretion never reached the judge in those cases, who might have made the same decisions had they not been bound by mandatory minimum sentences.
But prosecutors just stepped in right at the front end.
Prosecutors made the decision at the front end to not charge those because they took a look at the defendant and they said, you know, this is a person who, for whatever reasons, the particular circumstances of that person's case, and it may be because of the power of the parents. But in any event, that is just the sort of discretion that has been front-loaded in this system all too frequently. Sentences are harsher than ever. I mean, people are getting very long sentences. In 2001, more than 90% of the people who were convicted received some sort of prison sentence. And of those defendants, even people who were eligible for straight parole, almost half of them, 40% rather, received sentences.
Has that made America a safer place? I mean, crime rates have been down over the last decade.
Yeah, but I'm not sure that that is the consequence of the sentencing process. The crime rates had been going down already, and that it's a more complicated question to sort out what the crime rate sentencing relationship is. The point is that many, many people, and particularly low-level drug defendants who comprise something like 55% of the prison population today, are spending time. And those are people who are nonviolent, frequently first-time offenders. Nearly 72% of the women in federal prisons are there for drug law violations. More than half the drug defendants sentenced to federal prison are first-time offenders. So we're not talking about hardened criminals here. We're talking about a system that is warehousing people, and they're doing it principally because of the mandatory sentences, because sentences that are driven by drug quantity pretty much solely and not by the ability to look at an offender. And that's the beauty of the guideline system. If you eliminate the mandatory minimum sentence, the guideline system still allows judges to account for individualized determinations. The guideline system is a grid. You need to understand that if you look at it, it's 43 levels up one side dealing with the offense and six levels across the bottom. And what happens is you come to a box in the middle of that, and that is the sentence. And it is mandatory to the extent that that's the sentence that has to be given. But very, very wisely, Congress put into this system, and the Sentencing Commission put into the system, the ability for a judge to depart when that little itty-bitty box and the little circumstances that fit it didn't account for a particular circumstance that is attached to the defendant or to the offense. So it allows the judge to fit the punishment, to fit the crime, and to fit the offender. But it's also very guided. If a departure is unwarranted, the government can appeal that departure.
Robert Weisberg, Mayor Price, if I may, I want to just put on that point, turn to Robert Weisberg and ask, Professor Weisberg, if you think that this new monitoring that the Justice Department is going to do, this aggressive monitoring, will have the effect of pushing discretion more into the hands of prosecutors, taking more out of the hands of judges, and in total, tightening up federal sentencing.
Yes, probably, unless judges get their nerve up and, take the position that so long as they can possibly be removed from office for their normal judicial decisions, they can basically tell the Attorney General to go jump in a lake. The fact that he has no legal constraining power over them in this regard, it's a question of how they react, and it's at this point unpredictable. On the other hand, yes, judges are human, even if they are almost impossible to remove from office, and it is possible that just to avoid public calumny or just the annoyance of it, they're going to be more loath to depart than they have been.
And what about the argument that, in effect, what's being implemented here is an offense against the separation of powers?
Constitutionally, it isn't quite that because, again, it doesn't change the rule that a judge can't be sanctioned. Judges can't be removed from office. But I would say in terms of the kind of political spirit of the way the nation works, yes, there's no question about it. I mean, Ashcroft is not particularly sensitive to these matters. He is, by, you should pardon the term, constitutionally a bit of a control freak, and doesn't seem to really understand how prosecutors and how judges tend to operate, regardless of whether the prosecutors and judges have, Democratic or Republican leanings.
Benjamin's calling from Boston. Hello, Benjamin. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I have to say that the Wayne Ryder was found guilty for shoplifting. And she
Winona Ryder, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. She had a slap on the wrist. And all I have to say is that this is just a system that is designed to lock up poor American kids in jail, and particularly from the minority group.
Designed to lock up poor American kids? You mean the mandatory sentencing, the tough guidelines?
They targeted the crime that are more associated with poor neighborhood kids. And this has to do with the poor black and Hispanic kids. And they know that I run around with smoking marijuana or selling a few bags of marijuana for a dime or 20, like they used to say. So I think this is just designed to lock up those group of people in the neighborhood. That's all it is.
Got it. Benjamin, let me put that to Charles Hobson. Mr. Hobson, what about it? The idea that this tough sentencing is designed, in our caller's phrase, to lock up poor American kids.
Well, it's worth noting that the one that most that typically draws the greatest criticism is the mandatory minimums for crack cocaine. And Charles Rangel, African-American congressman from New York City,
yes,
was instrumental in getting the and he wasn't alone from the African-American community and other parts of the inner-city communities in getting the increased sentencing, substantially increased sentencing for crack cocaine.
Because it was so hard to root out crack cocaine. It was such a curse.
It was considered so dangerous and so horrible.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't – I mean – these things aren't unpopular. I can't imagine that anybody can really agree that it's some conspiracy to lock up large members of minority communities. As far as the Ryder sentence, it shows what happens when in that case, you don't have mandatory minimums in California for any sentences like that. And where you can afford outstanding counsel, you can sometimes get a very beneficial plea bargain. What one interesting thing, though, about the minimums is that at least it makes it clear to everybody what the actual penalty for the crime is.
Charles Thompson, do you agree with Robert Weisberg that at the state level we're seeing some retreat from the tough sentencing because it hasn't been effective enough and it's just too darned expensive to sustain?
The Rockefeller laws, which California never really had, drug sentencing laws as severe as the Rockefeller laws. That hasn't been the experience. I'm more familiar with California. There has been some in some states with the Rockefeller laws. But in California, once again, we're facing a $30-plus billion budget deficit, and there was no real effort to reduce criminal sentencing in any form because they knew it was a loser politically. Nobody was going to do it. People were because they knew that the voters didn't want that to happen. And obviously, the voters in California are angry about many, many things, and I guess people didn't want to add fuel to the fire. It's always been a dead loser here, and you will find it in some states. But it's important to note that's really where a lot of the real action occurs is in the state level.
Robert Weisberg, last word goes to you, and we just have 20 seconds here, but is American justice staying within a traditional channel? Is it still in touch with the kind of vision of the founders and tradition over the years here as it's playing out today?
Yes, I think the tradition that at some level there's an irreducible need for some individualized sentencing is probably alive and well, and the response to Congress and to Attorney General Ashcroft is probably a sign of that. I think there's going to be some backing and filling, but I suspect that just as the Feeney Amendment got weakened, I suspect the some of these moves by Mr. Ashcroft will probably be set back.
Well, the debate goes on, and we keep it loud and free. Robert Weisberg, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Robert Weisberg is Huddleston Professor of Law at Stanford University. Charles Hobson, our thanks to you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Charles Hobson is attorney with the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation in Sacramento, California, and Mary Price in Washington at the Families Against Mandatory Minimums. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In a moment, Liberia's president, Charles Taylor, steps down. This is On Point. Under pressure from rebel forces and the international community, Liberian President Charles Taylor stepped down today and flew into exile in Nigeria. Over the past 2 months, more than 2,000 people have died in Liberia's capital in fighting between rebels and forces loyal to Taylor. President Bush made Taylor's resignation a precondition for any substantial U.S. involvement in Liberia's civil war. Before he left office, Taylor took a parting shot at the United States and portrayed himself as a martyr during an address televised to his nation. Here are excerpts from Taylor's speech.
I challenge George Bush, with all due respect, Mr. President, please, you are a man of God, do something for our people. I did not want to leave this country. I can say I am being forced into exile by the world superpower. I have decided to leave because, for the first time in the history almost of the world, the United States is using food and other things as a weapon against the Liberian people. Because if the administration, President Bush says, that they will not step on this soil and will do nothing as long as I'm here, this further threatens your survival as a people. And as I have said, I can no longer see you suffer. The suffering is enough. But you are good people. You've been very good to me through the grace of God. And I love you from the bottom of my heart. I will always remember you wherever I am. And I say to you, God willing, I will be back. God bless you and save the state.
Former Liberian President Charles Taylor, in a nationally televised address delivered over the weekend. Taylor resigned from office earlier today. On Point News analyst Jack Beatty joins me now. Jack, what do you think? Does Taylor's resignation mean that the Liberian crisis is over?
No, it doesn't. This has a dynamic all its own. These rebels with their child soldiers are holding the port. There aren't enough Nigerian forces really to counter them, and they won't be for another three weeks. And meanwhile, Taylor says he'll be back. Imagine how that must sound in the consciousness of these people. You know, this may be the only man in history who ran for president, the president of his country, under the following slogan, something like this, very close to it. It appeared on posters. He killed your mom. He killed your pa. Vote for him or he'll kill you.
That doesn't sound like the silver-tongued sort of smooth guy that we just heard in his departing address.
No, and he's left his country, as one woman said of Monrovia today, a living hell. A humanitarian crisis there, people eating snails, the beaches turned into burial grounds, rape, women and men dying of gangrene.
U.S. warships have breached the horizon. They're now visible from the port there in Monrovia. Do you think those soldiers will come ashore, Jack?
Don Rumsfeld doesn't want them to, and Don Rumsfeld seems to run things with this government, so I wouldn't bet on it.
So more news to come from Monrovia and from Liberia. Jack Beatty, thanks for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for being with us. More at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this program comes from Sophus Anti-